Welcome to the show where we promote a biblically faithful and scientifically testable alternative to Darwinian evolution. And this is our August 9th, 2005 broadcast. And I'm live in studio right now with Drs. Hugh Ross and Fuzz Rana. And Fuzz, you know, it's about that time of year. It's hot and we all need a vacation.
That's right.
But you already had yours for the summer.
I've had two vacations this summer.
So you're well rested.
I am.
Several of us are going to be out of town next week, and I do want to mention that because, well, the studio will be dark next week. We won't have a broadcast on the 16th because pretty much everybody's going to be gone except Fuzz, and Fuzz didn't want to be here talking to himself for 2 hours. But the rest of us are going to be out. And Hugh, what are you up to these days?
Well, I'm trying to finish up this creation model book. My wife, Kathy, is busy editing it, and I mean, it is finished in the sense we got drafts of all the chapters, but the editing is what takes the longest by far, so we're in the midst of all that.
Still a ways to go.
We're getting close.
That's good.
So, and we're excited about what's going to be in the book.
And Fuzz, your book is getting pretty close to being released a little over a month from today.
Yeah, September 15th is the shelf date. But if people are pre-ordering the book from us, they probably will get the book before September 15th. I imagine we'll get it here in our warehouses, or a warehouse, I guess. We only have one.
Yeah.
Our warehouse.
Very small.
in the first part of September.
Now, you were on Catholic radio yesterday?
Yes, Catholic Family Radio.
How was that? What were they talking to you about?
They were interested in our perspective here at Reasons to Believe on the intelligent design controversy. You know, we take the position that ID should not be taught in the science classroom, at least in the public school system.
ID in its current form.
Yeah. Yes. We take the view that clearly the problems with biological evolution should be presented along with the strengths of the theory. That's honest academic approach to the issue. But we don't think ID is science yet. It's a very strong inference that there indeed is a creator that exists, at least the way ID is formulated. And that's why we are working here at Reasons to Believe to develop a testable creation model, because we're making an attempt to take this ID idea and incorporate it into a model that is truly a scientific model, though biblically derived, and a model that employs a creator.
And Fuzz, this is something that the ID movement itself, I don't think, would disagree with. I mean, they're not trying to get intelligent design taught in the public education.
Exactly.
They realize it's not at that point yet. So this is nothing new from their perspective.
Right.
Okay. I do want to give out the phone number real quick, 866-RTB-RADIO. And, you know, the question of the ID movement and our role in that at Reasons to Believe is a point of confusion sometimes and also a developing issue. So maybe if someone out there wants to call and wants Fuzz to clarify or Hugh to clarify some of the comments just made, and feel free to do that, 866-RTB-RADIO. We also want to share our perspectives on the scientific discoveries of the week and how they support RTB's testable creation model. Now, some of you may have seen Sunday night's presentation on the History Channel of the documentary Ape to Man. So we're going to start off the hour with some comments and thoughts about that and then segue into two rather fascinating discoveries, one related to Homo erectus, which was a major player in the whole Ape to Man documentary, as well as some startling new insights into the anatomy of Neanderthals. Here Fuzz is. He's written a whole book on something, and he learned something brand new as a result of this study. And later in the hour, we're going to be continuing our quest to solve more anomalies in the scientific record, those things which come up from time to time that don't fit our testable creation model. We're going to talk about another one today. Where are all those missing dwarf galaxies anyway, if we really do live in a cold, dark matter, Big Bang universe? We're going to talk about that. And in our time with Ken today, talk about the Nazi analogy, which is one of Ken's favorites, especially as it related to the Terri Schiavo case recently. Is sometimes it's also used in the abortion debate, leading editorial in Science recently, basically telling Christians to stop drawing all these parallels between abortion and the extermination of the Jews. And so, of course, anything with World War II, Ken's going to want to weigh in on that. 866-RTB-RADIO. All right, Fuzz, let's talk a little bit, and Hugh, too, about Ape to Man. We all watched it on Sunday night on the History Channel. And in a nutshell, basically what the documentary was, since it was on the History Channel, was a history of anthropology from the time of the discovery of the first Neanderthals in Germany in the late, is it 1800s?
Yes, 1850s.
Up to the genetic testing of Neanderthals in the late 90s.
Yes.
And I would have been happy if that's where it stopped. But
history lesson.
Right.
Yeah.
But the implication was it was not only a history of physical anthropology, it was a history of the human race itself. And it tried to make the claim that we were merely the product of natural descent, literally from some kind of ape species.
Kind of the thrust of it was the search for, the subtitle really should have been The Search for the Missing Link.
Right.
And all of these sort of rabbit trails they went down. Well, maybe the Neanderthal's the missing link, or maybe this is the missing link.
Right.
And they had four or five different
ones.
Well,
in a sense, it was a history of anthropology. So not only was it a history of the discoveries themselves that were major landmark discoveries in the quest for human origins, but it was also a history of evolutionary thought as it comes to the question of human origins, where the thought evolved, no pun intended, from looking for that single missing link to recognizing that the hominid fossil record is incredibly complex and that, quote unquote, the evolutionary tree is really this evolutionary bush or evolutionary lawn, which we would argue is actually deeply problematic for the evolutionary model, that you can't construct a clear consensus evolutionary tree from the data at hand. And in fact, this explosive appearance of hominids throughout the fossil record is best explained from our creation model perspective, where God is creating the hominids as animals, not as precursors to humans.
And I think that part of it at the end, the sort of the big punchline, I kept thinking, well, where are we going with this? And at the end, it was basically like, well, there's a lot more to discover out there, and sure enough, one day we're going to find that missing link. That was sort of what I came away with.
Yeah. Something I, too, found problematic, and I'm sure you probably were bothered by this, too, Hugh, was how the dramatic reenactments of the discoveries themselves I thought was quite fascinating. In
right.
fact, something that struck me was how lucky Mary Leakey was. Here's
right.
this lady driving along and a paint can falls down in her Jeep and she stops to adjust it and sees the first Homo habilis skull or,
yeah.
you know, she's taking the dogs for a walk, you know, when her husband
ooh,
is
there's a smooth
you know,
rock.
Sick from the flu, with the flu
yeah.
and, oh yeah, here's the, you know, what turns out to be Paranthropus Boise. So, I mean,
yeah.
What a lucky lady she was. You know, Lewis Leakey was just going along for the ride. It wasn't for Mary, you know.
He was down with the flu.
Yeah, but anyway, I thought those reenactments were good and seemed to be accurate based on what I know. But the dramatic reconstructions of the hominids, Neanderthals, and Erectus was just outlandish. It was so much artistic and cinematic license taken that it was almost to the point of being absurd.
Making them very human-like.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the absurdity, is that they were attributing human properties to them where the evidence said quite the opposite.
Well, give us some examples
them.
Of what those human properties were.
Well, I mean, for example, you saw them with clothing.
Right.
They were much more human-looking than what the bones would indicate, and their behavior was very human-like, and they tried to claim that their tool capability and sophistication was much more advanced than what it really was. The little episode about the fire, how they were able to capture fire. And
or the statement that when Homo erectus emerged, he lost body hair. Nobody knows that. I mean, you know, that's totally an unsubstantiated it's not a scientifically testable statement given the data at hand, but that was just, I thought, one of the most absurd statements.
Well, especially since there's good evidence that they weren't wearing clothing. I mean, you know, where are they going to get the protection?
Yeah.
It would be very confusing, though, I think, for the average person watching that program to be able to separate fact from fiction. I mean, if you don't know the body of literature as well as you guys do or as we talk about on Creation Update, it would be somewhat difficult, I think, to discern, you know, what part is true and what part of it is more based on worldview inferences. I don't know if either of you want to comment on that.
Yeah, I wasn't quite that pessimistic, Krista, because it seemed to me obvious that, you know, looking at it, okay, the historical reenactments are probably, I mean, if I knew nothing at all about what was going on, just looking at that, that would be my perspective. Okay, I mean, the reenactments of the Neanderthals and Homo erectus, that could well be out of left field, who knows. But the historical reenactments of the discoveries, that's probably right on. So I'm hoping the public discern what I did, but maybe I'm being a Pollyanna there.
I don't know. That was, I thought that was pretty, it would be pretty rough if I was, didn't know the stuff the way that you guys do. And it was all sort of mixed up in there together. And
well, I'll tell you what I was doing during the ad breaks. I mean, my TV set, the National Geographic Channel, is only two channels away from the History Channel. So every time there was an ad break, I went over to the National Geographic. They were running at the same time a series on human origins, but with a very interesting slant. They were trying to explain Goliath and his ilk, and made the interesting point that this isn't just a Bible, quote, myth. This is something that's well substantiated not only in many different passages of the Bible, but in historical records outside of the Bible. So they took the position that Goliath and the Nephilim were real, but tried to explain them as a sub-branch of the Neanderthals.
There's a discovery I'm going to be talking about today,
Hugh.
Yeah, that actually relates to that.
And make it believe it or not, relates to that. We'll make that impossible.
Yeah.
Wow. But that's where I was scary for the audience, Krista, saying, I wonder how many people watching this thing about Goliath are actually giving us any credibility. It just seemed totally preposterous what they were saying about Goliath and his Neanderthal roots.
It was I got to go to break soon, but I watched the documentary with my six-year-old, and in hindsight, that I probably shouldn't have done that. It was, I mean, I've gone over this whole evolutionary thing with her a lot, and I thought, well, I think she'll be able to watch this and be able to discern. After about 30 minutes, she turns to me and says, so we're descended from apes? And I thought, uh-oh. So, you know, I stopped it right there, gave her a pop quiz.
With TiVo, you can stop
yeah.
it.
I said, we're not watching any more of this until you answer the following questions correctly. And then I started going down the whole list of Adam and Eve and everything, and she got all the answers correct. We got it all straightened out. Then we went on. But it was, I think that the reenactments of the hominids that made them so human-like,
right.
I think that would be highly confusing to a layperson. Because if they don't know the literature, I mean, you just hear it ubiquitously that they used fire and that they wore clothes. I mean, Neanderthals wearing clothes is in every library book that I've ever seen that we've checked out from the library with my six-year-old. I mean, that's just out there. So I think that would have been very confusing to people if they didn't know.
Well, we got a good section on that in our book on human origins, why it's highly unlikely that Neanderthals wore clothes. I mean, the mere fact that they were far better adapted for cold than we humans, yet we find humans living in a colder clime than the Neanderthals.
Right. And there are no tools associated with Neanderthal finds that would indicate or that would be used to prepare clothing.
Like no needles.
Needles. And
what
like
about
that.
These spears that they had, that the Neanderthals had? Is that based on some finds?
They may or may not have used those types of implements. I think that's not clearly, in my mind, not clearly established.
Well, what was disturbing to me is there was a couple of times where they showed the Neanderthals using a combination of wood, stone, and sinew.
Which is not true.
Which is not true, right.
Oh, like tying the arrowheads
right.
on
exactly.
the
right. Yeah,
the
that's
spears.
Unique to humanity.
Oh, okay. So that part of it would not be.
Homo erectus, Neanderthals did not have that capability.
Right. Well, see, now I didn't even know that. There's a prime example. Very confusing. Okay, Fuzz, let's talk a little bit about the first one. This one relates to Homo erectus.
Right.
Which I believe from the documentary, I mean, he was featured in the Ape to Man documentary and played a rather prominent role. And if I'm remembering correctly, he's pretty much a major contender right now to be the most direct ancestor to modern humans.
Right. And when it comes to Homo erectus, you really are looking at a fairly complex area now in anthropology or paleoanthropology, because it used to be thought of Homo erectus as a single species. And now the designation Homo erectus is primarily for the Asian they call them the erectines.
Oh, okay.
So there's an Asian erectine that's Homo erectus proper. Homo ergaster is in Africa, and there's a number of other erectines that people are disputing whether they're just part of this whole conglomerate or are they individual species. So this whole lumper splitter debate that's going on. But you're right. I mean, traditionally Homo erectus or the erectines are considered to be part of this evolutionary trajectory that leads to ultimately to modern humans, again, from an evolutionary perspective. That's not a position that we would take at Reasons to Believe.
Now, what's the date range for the existence of these erectines?
About 1.8 million years ago to easily 500,000 years ago. There's even some people that argue Homo erectus may have persisted in Asia to 100,000 years ago. Some even argue perhaps 50,000 years ago, although that evidence is somewhat controversial. So erectus, at least in Asia, persisted for quite some time.
But what's not controversial is his existence from 1.8 to 0.5.
No, yeah. Yes, that's not controversial. No, it's not controversial. Sorry.
So now what we have here is we're getting some insights into Homo erectus juveniles or children, if you will, that and really the comparison here is, do they develop more like chimps or animal-like, or do they develop more like modern humans?
Right, because the evolutionary model would predict that as transitional forms, they should have some form of intermediate development that is more increasingly becoming more like humans and less like apes. And some time back, we talked about this Homo erectus specimen called the Mojo Kerto child. And this is interesting because this is the only Homo erectus infant that at least I'm aware of. And they recently had determined the age at the time of death to be about 1 to 1.5 years in age. And from that, they concluded that the brain size and the rate of brain size development was much more like a chimp than it was like a human. And this study is kind of a companion study to that, in a sense, in which they are looking at the internal structure of the skull and inferring information about brain shape. And from that, the bottom line is they conclude that the Mojo Kerto child and therefore the erectine's brain development was very non-human. Like, again, it was much more ape-like. And this really creates a greater distance between Homo erectus and modern humans. It widens the gap, if you will. It means that if somehow this is an intermediate form, the pace of brain evolution must have been quite dramatic and quite rapid, which doesn't make much sense from an evolutionary naturalistic perspective. Also, it's consistent with our view that Homo erectus and the other hominids were animals. They weren't humans or proto-humans, if you will, that they were truly animals. And this is in reinforcing that idea. It has implications in terms of the type of tool use and culture, quote-unquote, that they would be able to employ. So this is consistent with our model, and I think from an evolutionary perspective just distances the erectines significantly from modern humans.
Now, Fuzz, is there anything in this research to reflect on the development of the bipedal capability as you go from infancy to adulthood, or has that not yet been done?
That very well may have been done for Homo erectus. I just simply don't know. Part of the problem is, you know, having a complete skeleton, because
right.
to make that assessment, you need a fairly complete postcranial skeleton. And I don't think you've got much by way of that other than like the Turkana boy, for example.
Well, that was going to be my next question. We have this infant at a year to year and a half. What's the next step? I mean, where do we have the next youngest fossil?
I'm not certain of. I just don't know.
But we got nothing in the neighborhood of 2 or 3 or 4 years.
I don't know. I don't think that's the case. I think Turkana boy was 8 or 9 years old
All right.
when he died.
Mm-hmm.
So I just don't know all the specific erectine finds to really answer that question.
And what's your comment? I mean, I noticed on the TV show Sunday Night, they claimed that Homo erectus had an average height of 6 feet.
That's not right.
It's
I've in the literature, I've seen heights closer to 5 feet.
5 feet is what I've seen, too.
Yeah, and that was a...
I mean, I'm even wondering if it would be a stretch to say that the maximum height was 6 feet. I don't know of anything that tall. And the other thing I noted, Fuzz, is that they showed Homo erectus as having a bipedalism that's identical to what we've manifest.
Yeah.
And what's your comment on that?
That's not the case either. They did employ what's called obligatory bipedalism.
Right.
But there is work done where on a multivariate statistical study on the pelvis, the pelvises of a number of hominids, and the conclusion was while erectus and Neanderthals employed obligatory bipedalism, their bipedalism appeared to be distinct from that of modern humans, given the nature of the pelvis.
Right.
So that clearly is...
That was a major problem in that documentary Sunday night.
You know, one thing that I thought was kind of fun with the documentary is like watching sports on the Fox Channel, because when the hominids would come up, this swooshing sound would come up and boom, up pops the vital statistics. So it's like you're getting the statistics for the sports figure. But anyway, I thought I was watching Fox on or sports
Fox
on
sports.
Sports on Fox there. But
okay, so let's move on and talk about the second discovery we have today on human origins, Fuzz. This one relates to Neanderthals, who were also a major player in the Ape to Man documentary the other night.
Now, this is a paper that was published in a recent issue of a journal called the Anatomical Record, and there is a part of the journal called the B part, which is New Anatomy. And this is an interesting study. And Hugh, I'm wondering if you knew this. I didn't know this. Nobody has ever done a true Neanderthal reconstruction of the entire skeleton. Now, I was under the impression that that had been done because you see what appear to be these true reconstructions. And there's a number of Neanderthals' remains that are nearly complete.
Right.
Turns out nobody's ever done that. What they've done is reconstructions where it's a hybrid between a Neanderthal skeleton and human skeleton, where they use human skeletal parts
to fill in the gaps,
fill in the missing skeletal components. And there's a lot of artistic license that's taken. Well, these two researchers decided to do a true reconstruction. They took what's known as the Laferese 1 specimen, which is nearly complete, and then they filled in the missing pieces with casts from Neanderthals that are about the same size.
Right.
And what they discovered was actually quite shocking. It turns out, number one, that the stature of Neanderthals was probably about 5 feet. They were much shorter. They virtually had no waist, according to this analysis, and the rib cage and the pelvis was dramatically different from that of modern humans. So they're and they conclude there's just
and short limbs that were confirmed.
Yes. So they're bulky and kind of robust in terms of their skeleton, but they were quite short.
So roly-poly short guys.
Yes. So. This means that the reconstructions that you saw on the History Channel were even far more inaccurate.
Those are pretty human-like.
Yeah, far more inaccurate than what anybody really had known.
Well, it was one kudo for the National Geographic special on Goliath is that they showed Neanderthal as being very bulky and robust in musculature. And short. So,
but up until this the publication of this paper, the assumption was Neanderthals were fairly high in stature, or tall. Whereas this study indicates that wasn't the case. But the difference is so dramatic. They're arguing Neanderthals can't be evolutionarily connected to modern humans. They clearly are a side branch, and this means that they couldn't be Goliath either.
Right.
Yeah, a little height problem there.
But I think that's interesting. And again, it goes back to a theme that we've been talking about in this Ape to Man documentary about the use of artistic license in doing the reconstructions of what these hominids were like. It many times it's much more art than it is science. There's a lot of liberty that's taken. There's an over-attribution of human qualities that come from this artistic depiction. And I think it's very difficult for the average person to recognize what is art and what is science. And this study really shows that even anthropologists are victimized by these artistic reconstructions.
Now, referring to art, in their paper, did they actually show artistically what this creature looks like?
No, but they do have a picture of the reconstruction. And actually, it's on display Goodness, where is it on display at? It's actually on display. Their reconstruction is on display.
That's what I was asking.
At a museum. But it's not – it's just a skeleton. It's not the putting the flesh to the skeleton.
But the reconstructed skeleton mm-hmm. is there.
Yes.
I'm wondering if there's any way that we could get permission to actually post that on our website. That'd be kind of fun to actually.
Yeah, yeah, the reconstructed skeleton is currently on display at the Dolan DNA Learning Center in Cold Spring Harbor, New York, and will eventually go on permanent display at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. So,
interesting.
But it's not available on the web yet?
No, other than this.
What you see there.
Yeah, so I'm holding up this picture for
our
friends in radio land.
Oh, that wouldn't be so funny, except we've had guests do that before. Let's see here, guys, since we're on the topic of human origins and sort of the evolutionary family of the discussion before we move into astronomy, there was a recent little... I don't know what this is. This is an editorial in Science.
Yeah, letter to the editor.
Letter to the editor, okay, in Science about the ID movement. And it's always a hot button in the scientific community right now. But basically, it seems like the scientific community has largely adopted the strategy of how we're going to deal with the ID people is that we're going to ignore them. We're not going to try to debate them. We're not going to try to engage them. We're just going to ignore them because by ignoring them, they're not giving them their views credence and not validating them in any way.
Right.
But now here's this guy is suggesting a slightly different approach.
Yeah, this is a geoscientist from the University of Massachusetts, Donald Wise, and he wrote this letter to encourage the scientific community to take on the intelligent design leaders.
So this is more of like a go on the offensive.
Right. Well, I mean, his comment is that in public confrontations, the scientists have tended to be defensive. He's encouraging they go on the offensive. And what he's recommending here, in fact, what he does is he actually gives scientists a script for confronting intelligent design speakers.
Probably not a good idea to publish that, though, if you really want it to be effective.
Right. Well, I think he's giving an example. And basically, his advice is ignore what the intelligent design speaker is saying. Don't respond to his message. Rather, what you want to do is go on the offensive and provide a list of evidences for what he calls incompetent design. In fact, in tongue-in-cheek, he says, I got a new idea of what ID stands for, incompetent design. But what he notes in his letter is in terms of trying to come up with a list of bad designs in nature, they all focus on the human species. And he's trying to claim that human beings are a very badly designed species. And because of just how horribly we are designed, this can't be the product of a divine being. In particular, can't be the product of God of the Bible. And I thought it'd be good to actually read his script for constituents for the simple challenge. All of those of you out listening there, how would you respond to this kind of aggressive attack on the Christian faith? And what he says is, quote, you have a philosophic choice between evolution or belief in ID, so-called intelligent design. But even a first-year engineering student would be embarrassed to have designed your lower back with the extreme bend that allows you to stand erect, even though your pelvis slants forward for knuckle dragging like all of our near relatives. You probably have had braces or wisdom teeth extracted because there are too many teeth for the size of your mouth. Then there are your sinuses with a flawed drainage system that would provoke laughter from a plumber. Yet evolution provides a ready and rational explanation for all these design failures by progressive changes in an erect posture, by shortening of a mammalian muzzle into a face, and by expansion of our large brains to crowd the facial bones. So take your choice. Do you prefer evolution or an ID whose letters may well stand for incompetent design, end quote. And, you know, Fuzz, in looking at this, I think it'd be good to advice to people listening there is that when you hear an example of bad design, don't immediately respond and try to correct the misperceptions about the bad design. A much better way is to kind of lay out some principles that you could apply to any example of bad design. Because the problem is if you focus on refuting one example, they'll say, oh, well, we have a bunch more. it's better to lay out some basic principles.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
And also the laying out of basic principles might take some of the edge off the hostility. I mean, you can kind of hear the mocking tone in that script that he developed. And I think it's always good to try to deal with that with a principle that will help relieve some of the hostility and the mockery. And one would be to say, well, you know, that's an interesting example that you propose. This gives us another opportunity to put our model and your model to the test. You know, here we have this example that you think is bad design. We would look at it and say it's good design. Let's encourage medical researchers to do more research on the human body, to do more research on anthropology, and to see whether or not that additional research promotes superior design or inferior design. We can wait a few months and see which way the research will go. Another basic principle is to simply point out, isn't it interesting that these examples you've presented are all in the arena of the most complex end of the creation evolution spectrum, where we have the greatest lack of understanding, you know, of why these features of design show up in the human body. And wouldn't it be a good idea to try to interpret the complex in light of the simple? Let's find a design problem that's better understood than these, which both sides would have to agree we lack complete understanding. Yeah. Let's find one where understanding is virtually complete and see what the evidence there lies. And if it's in the direction of supernatural design, then that should give us some measure of humility when we come to something that we don't completely comprehend.
You know, something that it bears on my experience in product development for a number of years is also to recognize that many times suboptimality doesn't mean that it's not designed, because when you're developing a product, there are trade-offs. There are certain right. attributes that the product has that simply cannot coexist in optimal form in a product for that product to ultimately perform in an optimal way.
Yeah, an obvious example would be a high-performance gas-efficient vehicle. I mean, the two go against one another.
Exactly.
You cannot have high gas efficiency and high engine performance.
And so typically what the engineer does is determines what is the most important thing for the consumer.
Right.
Or who's going to, you know, and is it high performance? Then what you do is you suboptimize the performance just enough that you get an acceptable level of gas efficiency.
Right.
But you can't have both at the same time.
Right.
And so the point is many times engineers intentionally introduce suboptimality of individual components in order to achieve overall optimality for the system. And that very well could be the case for the human body, that there very well may be suboptimal designs in isolation, but that in terms of the contribution to the overall body makeup, that may be optimal designs. So, for example, the pelvis is doing more than just simply supporting bipedalism, but we have to sit down.
Right.
Women give childbirth or give
birth children. Yeah, that pelvis
has got
to make it through the birth canal.
So, I mean, that's a factor that is part of how the pelvis is structured.
Well, one thing that struck me, too, is that in one sense, Donald Wise is right. There's evolution going on here. This is evidence for evolution, but it's not Darwinian evolution. It's evidence for developmental evolution, how we start off as an infant weighing only a few pounds and grow up to be an adult that's fully capable weighing 150 pounds. And that developmental process has its consequences. You know, the whole argument about the teeth. Well, if that child is raised in such a way that it's chewing on very rough, difficult to massage food, then the jaw will develop to be a bigger size with stronger jaw muscles to support that. However, if the child is raised with processed soft food, which is typical in advanced technological society, then the jaw isn't stressed to the same degree and therefore will be smaller. The teeth will be crowded out. But I look at that as part of the wisdom of our supernatural creator. Our supernatural creator realized that at the dawn of human existence, we wouldn't have high-tech dentists, and therefore made sure that we were designed in such a way that we would have the teeth that we would need to exist in that situation. And then when we developed to a point where we had high technology, affluent civilization, where we would be transitioning to softer foods, at that point we would have the the technology of going to a dentist to extract the teeth that we no longer need.
Well, you know, and Donald Wise's argument would have validity if everybody had to have their wisdom teeth extracted.
Right.
I've never had my wisdom teeth extracted. My mouth is big enough to accommodate my wisdom teeth. Now, Krista, stop laughing.
But, I was going to say that simply reflects that maybe you had a different diet when you were raised as a little boy than I had. So,
but I guess the point is that if you're going to make this universal claim that this is a bad design, then I think, you know, the fact that there are people that don't have wisdom teeth extracted, I think indicates is in support, I think, of what you were saying, Hugh.
Right.
But examples of bad design, I mean, that's not especially a novel argument. I mean, it seems like we've talked about these general principles many times on the show.
In fact, in our message of the month a year ago,
when we did the series on evolution, we had a whole—
Or the problem of evil, I think.
One of them, maybe even both. When we did a whole thing on this question.
Well, these imperfections in nature, as an argument for evolution and against design, is a commonplace argument. In fact, there's the metaphysical problem of evil that Leibniz identified, which is essentially the same argument.
Right.
So basically, Hugh, in a nutshell, your approach to this is, let's just put it to the test. And if this is bad design, then the more that we study it, the more it will be evident that this is a poor design. Or if it's a good design, the more we study it, that will be evident.
Right. And you can speed things up by giving people a quick history lesson. I mean, scientists in the past have raised up examples of bad designs, like the panda's thumb. Like
junk DNA.
Junk DNA, the human appendix. And now science has advanced to a point where we realize that those scientists who raised those objections were flat out wrong. We understand that the appendix does serve a good purpose, that the panda's thumb is very elegantly designed for the diet that God had ordained for it. And what was the other example I threw out? Panda's thumb, the
appendix. And junk DNA.
And junk DNA. And likewise, we're now understanding that this junk DNA is highly functional.
Yep.
So,
okay, let's do. Let's at least start on this discovery here, and if
sure.
we have to pick it up, we'll do that. But we're talking about in Hugh's discoveries today. He wants to talk about a couple of anomalies, and it's been a theme lately. It seems, Hugh, of new insights bringing better understanding to things that were somewhat questionable before. And
right.
So this one, it relates to the question of if we really do live in a cold, dark matter, Big Bang universe, as opposed to a warm or hot, dark matter, the anomaly has been, then where are all the quote-unquote missing dwarf galaxies? Because apparently that would be a prediction that would come out of
Let me give a little bit of background first.
I'm trying to give the nutshell, but
okay.
Go ahead. Now go to the background.
Sure. It's now ubiquitously recognized that the universe is dominated by exotic dark matter. Of all you look at is the matter. Dark energy is a dominant component, but the second most dominant component is what we call exotic dark matter. And this is matter that does not interact well with radiation, unlike what we have with ordinary matter made up of protons, neutrons, and electrons. But astronomers have identified that this exotic dark matter can exist in three different forms: hot, warm, or cold. And what they mean by that is that the exotic dark matter particles, if they're moving at slow velocities, we call that cold exotic dark matter. If it's moving at relativistic velocities, we call that hot exotic dark matter. And if it's in between, we call it warm. Now, in terms of looking at the cosmic background radiation, the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, those two lines of evidence are supporting the idea that the universe is predominantly made up of exotic cold dark matter in terms of its matter constituency, with probably a smattering of warm exotic dark matter and hot exotic dark matter. But when we work out the mathematical models for the dynamics of the development of the universe based on the assumption that exotic dark matter is predominantly cold, those models, without exception, predict that the universe should contain more than 10 times as many dwarf galaxies as what we see. I mean, kind of the picture you get in the exotic cold dark matter model is that the universe starts off with nothing but dwarf galaxies. These dwarf galaxies begin to merge to make medium-sized galaxies, and then a few of the medium-sized galaxies will merge to make giant galaxies. And indeed, as you look through your telescope far away in the universe, you can see episodes where galaxies are merging together. This is called the hierarchical model for galaxy formation, where galaxies start small, merge to be medium-sized, then a few merge to become large galaxies. But that model predicts that we should be seeing way more dwarfs than what we actually see. Well, now comes this new discovery. It's a team of astronomers, an international team, very large team, that's using brand new instrument technology to look for extremely faint dwarf galaxies. And this was published in the Astrophysical Journal Letters. It's the first ever discovery of an extremely faint dwarf galaxy. And what they wind up concluding is that, you know, if we were to employ this technology to much greater depth than what they've done, use this technology to do deep surveys over much of the universe, we stand the possibility of discovering scads of these faint dwarf galaxies. And that being the case, it would resolve this anomaly in the cold dark matter model. And resolving that anomaly, it would firm up the confirmation that indeed the universe is extremely exquisitely fine-tuned in terms of its density parameters, the density of dark energy, the density of exotic dark matter, and the density of ordinary dark matter. Would all need to be extraordinarily fine-tuned to make life possible. So resolving this anomaly really gives much more weight of evidence that indeed we are seeing this incredible fine-tuning in the cosmic density parameters. And is also encouraging astronomers that it looks like we're right that the universe is predominantly cold dark matter, although I think we should continue to look for the warm stuff and the hot stuff.
Always testing, putting it to the test. Now, so basically what sounds like what you're saying is the issue here was really one of a technological barrier. And once that we got to a certain point, then we were able to have better instruments and be able to detect these dwarf galaxies.
To be more specific, if you look at our local group, and this is where this thing was found, in the local group. I mean, trying to detect these things beyond the local group would be very difficult.
Now, local group, that's a cluster of galaxies?
It's a cluster of galaxies in which our Milky Way galaxy lives. It's an extremely tiny cluster. Your typical cluster is 10,000-plus members.
So it's sort of our galactic neighborhood.
It's our galactic neighborhood. It only has two dozen members, two dozen that we've detected so far. And of those two dozen, there's only two large galaxies, the Milky Way galaxy and the Andromeda galaxy. All the other members are dwarf galaxies. But what this discovery is telling us is that there's a whole new population of dwarf galaxies out there waiting to be discovered. And the problem was astronomers had assumed that all dwarf galaxies would be bright enough that our telescopes would be able to easily detect them. This is telling us that that's not the case, that there's plenty of dwarf galaxies out there that are predominantly gas and small stars and therefore are going to be very difficult to detect. But now we got the technology to go after them and to put this model to the test.
Hugh, is the brightness of a galaxy simply determined by the number of stars that are in it or by the types of stars that are part of the galaxy?
It's the type of stars and the density of stars. The problem with a lot of these dwarf galaxies is the stars are spread quite far apart.
I see.
And if they're spread quite far apart, then the integrated light from the stars won't be bright enough to pick it up. And also, if all the stars are small, say smaller than our star, the Sun, they won't be bright enough. I mean, the point here, Fuzz, is that the brightness with which a star shines is proportional to the fourth power of its mass. So if you don't have any massive stars giving forth light, you're not going to be able to see these things easily. And that's the problem. This faint galaxy that they found, that's exactly what it was a bunch of small stars spread far apart from one another, unlike a globular cluster, and therefore very difficult to detect. I mean, the light was just spread out too thinly to pick up easily.
Joining us now at the table is our friend Kenneth Samples. Welcome, Ken.
Hi, nice to be with you.
And we are, well, see, now the calls are coming in. They're all waiting for you, Ken.
I guess so.
We're going to talk a little bit about an editorial that was in Science Magazine or the journal Science recently. And
in fact, it was the lead editorial.
Oh, it was the lead editorial. Yeah. Okay. And this is from the July 22nd, 2005 issue of Science. And really, Ken, the heart of what this gentleman's concern is, and he's a professor of medical ethics.
Arthur Kaplan is very well known.
Is he known?
He's very well known.
Okay, so
yeah,
but I'm not big
the
in the ethics.
So.
And I think he even is conservative, actually, in his bioethics, if
but
I'm not mistaken.
He's really taking exception with the use of the Nazi analogy, is what he's calling it, where, you know, there's a tendency sometimes when we talk about stem cell research or euthanasia or abortion to say, well, this devaluing of human life is analogous to Nazi Germany and the extermination of millions of Jews. And we've even talked about this on the Terry Schiavo case, and I think you have used this analogy and kind of wanted to get some thoughts and comments about Dr. Kaplan's editorial.
Yeah, well, the first point I would make is if science is going to start writing about the Nazis, I'm going to start reading science.
Something to thank God for today.
You know, I read the article, and I really appreciate you guys bringing it to my attention. Let me say, first of all, that I agree with him that there is a cavalier usage of the Nazi analogy in comparison.
So we shouldn't call anybody we disagree with Nazis just as the first step.
That's right. I mean, I think he makes a principle there that there was great suffering that took place in the Holocaust. I think the systematic extermination of the Jewish people and other ethnic minorities may be the greatest example of evil that we've seen in human history, although the communists certainly may have a challenge. So I think his basic point is a fair one. Even evangelicals at time. I remember evangelicals suggesting that if you think the church is spiritual Israel, then you are laying the groundwork for anti-Semitism.
Yeah, I've heard that charge before,
I think that is a bunch of malarkey. So he makes a good point. However, I also take him to task on a couple issues here. I think Kaplan has not appreciated something very important, and that is that there really are philosophical, ethical, and moral parallels between Nazi Germany and the kinds of ethical issues that we're wrestling with today in America.
Anytime you use an argument from analogy, the best way to do that is to make sure that your the two things that you're comparing are as tight as possible.
That's exactly right. And certainly there are going to be times where ethical issues today will be like and unlike what went on in Nazi Germany. So your analogy is going to have similarity and dissimilarity. Let me mention, however, some things that I think have direct parallel and issues that I think we should be concerned with. What about the issue of life versus the quality of life? Well, what did the Nazis think of Jews in terms of the quality of life? They thought they had no quality of life. They had no worth to the state. That seems to me to at least be a parallel that people should be concerned with. Another issue is the role of the state versus the individual. A third one would be the greater good for society. Well, what is the greater good for society? That we take the stem cells from embryos so that we can benefit other people? Well, however you think about that ethical issue, it has some parallel to the question of whether the Nazi state can just rape and rob and take whatever it wants. So there are parallel type of issues. I think another point that's worth
Let me give another parallel here, Ken.
Okay.
That is the matter of degree. I think the tone of this article is that, you know, Christians simply aren't appreciating the degree of evil in Nazi Germany and their analogies. But if we were to compare the number of deaths through abortion to the number of deaths through the Nazi prison camps, guess which wins? It's the death through abortions that are far more numerous than the deaths through the Nazi prison camps. So on that basis, we could argue that the analogy is certainly fair.
But you know, to bring up this idea that destroying human life is repugnant, and by comparing that with the destruction of human life in Nazi Germany, I think in no way diminishes the seriousness or makes it cavalier the seriousness of what happened in Nazi Germany. I don't think it undermines it. I think it's a way of highlighting just how serious an issue embryonic stem cell research is, and abortion and cloning. here in America today.
I think that's exactly right. And I wonder, and it would be great to talk with Dr. Kaplan, but I wonder if Dr. Kaplan would even agree with us that any human person that is yet to be born has the same status of those who are born.
Right.
And let me make another point that I think is very relevant to this issue, and I would probably take issue with Dr. Kaplan on this point. I think this can clearly happen again. And if we have an attitude that there are certain groups of people, maybe the unborn, the embryos, those who are vulnerable and fragile, if the state decides that these people are unworthy of life for whatever philosophical or ethical issues, that seems to me to have a parallel in this view that human beings do not have inherent dignity and moral worth. I don't think Nazi Germany was caused by anti-Semitic Christians. I think Nazi Germany in principle was caused by a breakdown in any kind of Judeo-Christian principle and an embracing of secularism. Nazism was a secular movement, and that's often not appreciated.
It was humbling to me a few weeks ago is to get a letter from one of our supporters in Germany just after the Terri Schiavo incident, making the comment that that would never happen in Germany. His comment was, "We went through the Nazis. We learned our lesson from what happened under Adolf Hitler, and never again would we pull a feeding tube from someone like Terri Schiavo."
They said then that letter, it was like a very clear parallel for that missionary in Germany, that the Germans saw it that way.
The Germans saw it that way.
This was a clear parallel between Nazi Germany and the Terri Schiavo case.
Now I'll give you a time where I think it was used cavalierly. PETA compared the boiling of chickens to the Nazi death camps. Now, there is where I think Kaplan could come and say there are some problems with this.
Yeah.
So, but he mentions that right here, animal experimentation has been improperly. So, I mean, parts of what he's got to say in his editorial I think are right on.
Yes, yes.
So it's a good lesson, though, and a good reminder to us as Christians that when we're making an argument based on analogy, you want to make sure that what you're arguing is as tight of an analogy as possible. We want to be careful in how we go about doing that.
And reasoning from analogy, by the way, is the most common way in which people reason. So it is something we want to be careful about in making comparisons. And we do it in apologetics. We do it in science. We do it in philosophy. We want to try to do it carefully.
We on this show all the time, the molecular motors fuzz is an argument from analogy. Okay, Ken, let's go out and talk to our friend Ian. And I think he has a question that maybe you can weigh in on. Welcome, Ian.
Yeah, thank you. This is kind of a follow-up to a segment you had 3 or 4 weeks ago on open theism, if you recall that. And I'm in agreement with your position. I believe that God is both omnipotent and omniscient. But my question is regarding, there are numerous passages in the Bible that talk about God changing his mind. And the argument I've often heard is that is merely an attempt to personify God, much like saying that God has eyes or God has hands, when we know, in fact, he doesn't, per se. But for me, those explanations really aren't sufficient, because I would say a statement like God changing his mind is in a different category than that.
Ian, let me jump in on this first,
because
years ago I did a study for our church on all the examples where God changes his mind. And what's really interesting is you go through that survey, you discover that it's always in response to humans changing their mind. When the Bible talks about God changing his mind, it's because humans repented, and God acknowledges human repentance and therefore deals with humans differently. So it's not that God has changed, it's that humans have changed.
Is this like in the Jonah Nineveh example?
That's one example.
Okay.
But, you know, there are many other examples in the Bible where God is changing the way he deals with an individual, but is always in response to the repentance of that individual. So it's God being perfectly consistent with his character, in the sense that he will treat us in the way according to how we respond.
Well, to press the point a little, you know.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm thinking specifically of some passages regarding Moses, where the Israelites are being disobedient. God is going to, do away with some or all of them. And Moses intercedes and makes a plea for the people. And it says God changed his mind. The people's behavior hasn't changed. It was Moses' intervention that somehow, at least in appearance, made it look like God changed his mind.
But isn't that... I'm stepping all over you again.
Sorry. Right, not going to get a chance here.
I won't call you a Nazi.
Yeah. But isn't that really sort of... Maybe Ken wants to talk about this too, but it seems to me that in the Moses example, that's a type or a shadow of Christ being our mediator. I mean, God has already condemned us as sinners. I mean, but then through Christ has brought us into redemption and turned away the wrath of God. And in that sense, the Son dies... Christ died... for our justification and to appease the wrath of the Father. And
Ian, let me bring in a couple things. I like what Hugh and Krista had to say. Let me bring in just a couple other things. Number one of the things that the Bible is very clear about is that God is immutable. That is one of his characteristics. It's one of his attributes, that when it comes to his being, his personhood, his will, that he does not change. To say that God changes would be to imply something to his nature that is like that of a creature. Now, the problem here is that God doesn't learn the way we learn. God's knowledge is not like ours. You know, I learn things chronologically. I draw inferences and then am able to appeal to a conclusion. All of God's knowledge is immediate. God doesn't go through processes of learning. This is kind of the classical way that Christian thinkers have thought about God. I would say that Hugh is very much right in these contexts. Often the emphasis, whether it is with Moses, whether it is with Abraham, or any other place, it is an emphasis to illustrate God's justice in dealing with people, and often the result is in terms of their repentance. I don't think, though, we should lose sight of the fact that often the Bible is written in a way in which to convey a story to human beings. I mean, think of Adam when he sinned. God appears in the garden and says, well, Adam, where are you? Did an infinite, eternal, unchanging being lose sight of where one of the creatures were? Or is this a way of conveying the use of language? Adam, has something happened that would make you hide from me? So I don't accept the interpretation given by the open theists that these passages actually illustrate that God doesn't know things, or God changes his mind, or God is like a creature where he goes through this type of process. In fact, interpreting these passages this way would contradict a whole set of other passages that say God does not change.
Now, let me get to the Moses passage, because I've heard that one quite often in my own teaching. People bring that one up. And I like to give the parallel passage of how God dealt with Abraham concerning Sodom and Gomorrah. And what God pointed out to Abraham in Genesis is, look, if there is a certain number of people that are righteous, then I will act this way. But if they're not, I'm going to act this way. And God communicated with Abraham to show him that the number of people that were righteous inside the city of Sodom were below that limit. Moreover, he was going to rescue those who were at that point. So he took Lot and his family out. The message was basically to Abraham, there's no one else there that's righteous except for Lot and his family, and I'm going to pull them out. And likewise, in the case of Moses, when God says, I'm going to destroy them all, what he's trying to do is get Moses to realize just how close the Israelite population is to that lower limit. And, you know, as Moses deals with God, it becomes quite clear that it's not just Moses. There's Joshua there's Caleb there are others. But Moses gets the idea. This situation is serious. It's desperate. And therefore, we see Moses taking action he otherwise wouldn't take. Keep in mind, this is a meek man who is not assertive. And God is using this message, this communication with Moses, to get him to take the kind of assertive action that's necessary as a leader. Now, I'm not a very assertive person. And so I can appreciate reading that text. Aha, God is trying to tell Moses, this is the time to get assertive. And it took that communication to motivate Moses to that assertive action. What do you think, Ken?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that often what we discover in Scripture is that God is utilizing these experiences. He is communicating to his creatures in ways in which they can understand to get them to appreciate his justice, his forgiveness. And to tie in Krista's point, that ultimately there will be a way in which God will forgive these people and show his mercy. So, Ian, I'm unconvinced by the exegetical support that the open theists present.
I think, Ken, your approach to this question, it sounds like, is I'm not necessarily 100% sure what these God changed his mind passages are, but they're not this.
Yeah.
They're not God changing his character or his mind in terms of time and space.
That's right. And there may be several ways of explaining.
Right.
Them.
So you're open to other hypotheses, but you're kind of drawing the line on where we're not going to go.
Right.
Okay.
Now, Ian, what do you got to say?
No, that's very helpful. So, you know, and I don't know Hebrew, but I would fathom to guess and kind of to summarize what you're saying is the meaning really is not so much I will destroy them, but I should destroy them, or I would be completely justified by destroying them. However,
exactly. Yeah,
that's right.
Exactly.
Well, you know, maybe an analogy that might be helpful comes from interaction as between a parent and a child. Suppose you come home and you see that your wife's favorite vase is laying in tatters on the floor, and the first question you ask is, "What happened here?" And it's kind of like you're saying with the Garden of Eden example. Of course, you know what happened, okay? But it's a rhetorical question to get the child to confess, to acknowledge the mistake they made, and the child comes into the room and they're in tears and they say, "I broke the vase. I was throwing a ball in the living room. I wasn't supposed to. I broke the vase." And then you say, "You know, I was going to spank you, but because you told me the truth and you acknowledged your error, I'm not going to spank you. You just have to help clean up the mess." So in a sense, you've changed your mind, but all along you never really intended to spank the child if the child behaved in a certain way. You weren't changing your mind, but you were responding. You already had the if-then scenario in your mind before you interacted with the child. And is that not what God is doing?
And to build on what I think is a fair analogy, Fuzz, you are utilizing – you're telling a story that the child can then understand and utilize. John Calvin once said that God often has to speak to us in baby talk. That is, he has to commune with us in a way that human beings can understand. And I think there it's preferable to see those passages in that context rather than to think of God as if God has limitations, imperfections, or a lack of knowledge.
Okay, I hope that helps you out, Ian. Okay, let's go out and talk to Jeff, who's been patiently waiting for us. Welcome, Jeff.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I had a follow-up question on the ID versus evolution question. One day last week, after President Bush's statement, the Rocky Mountain News, our one of the Denver newspapers here, had an editorial, and they editorialized against teaching ID in the public schools, which you guys said earlier you would agree with that position.
And so would the Discovery Institute, by the way.
Hello?
I said, so would the Discovery Institute, by the way, which is kind of the ID think tank. They take a similar position.
I see. Okay. Well, the reason that the Rocky Mountain News gave was the fact that theory of evolution, they pointed out, has led to fruitful research in the field of biology for, 100 or close to 150 years, I guess. Now, I'm not an expert on biology. That's not my background, but I thought that was a very good point, and I wondered how you would respond to that. It really surprised me that a newspaper had that good of an understanding of science, that one of the indicators of a validity of a scientific theory is that it leads to fruitful research.
Kind of the idea here is, I think, Fuzz, would a promotion of an intelligent design point of view cause us to sort of fall into maybe intellectual laziness or a God of the gaps type
right.
of argument. Well, it's just God. You know, why do we need to look into things?
You know, I would disagree with that in the sense that, let's say, the work that's been happening in paleontology over the last 150 years, it's hard to say that that research was motivated by the theory of biological evolution. People prior to the theory of evolution were discovering these fossilized animal remains in geological layers and were obviously interested in what does this mean and would have looked for these – continued to look for fossils whether or not the theory of biological evolution was part of the discipline of biology. I think just sheer human curiosity would have compelled that.
That's a great point, Fuzz, because when I've heard his argument that evolution is more productive scientifically than I ask for examples, they talk to me about the Big Bang and stellar evolution. Well, those are things that we teach from a creation perspective. It's no different. We're not arguing against the history of the record of nature or the data. And so there the productivity is the same. However, I do think that this is raising an excellent question. If our biblical creation model indeed is correct, as opposed to the naturalistic evolutionary model, it should be more productive in fostering scientific research than their model. And this is what I'm excited about with our Human Origins book. I mean, you've got a chapter in the book where you make an excellent example of where the naturalistic Darwinian model actually stopped scientific advance with respect to junk DNA. And it took 35 years for the scientific community to let go of their evolutionary bias and actually look for purpose. In fact, what was really ironic to me is it took an article published in Physical Review Letters to break the logjam. It was a bunch of physicists who said, look, you know, there really is something going on here. And that opened up a whole new arena of scientific research. And now research in junk DNA, so-called junk DNA, it's just catapulted in the last 10 years.
I mean, it's a minor revolution that's happening within molecular biology. And it's a clear paradigm shift from junk to recognizing function.
Right.
And the theory of evolution basically stymied that investigation, is what you're saying.
Exactly, right. Because when these non-coding DNA sequences were discovered, they were interpreted as junk, as a byproduct of the evolutionary process. Well, what researcher in his right mind is going to invest his career into that type of research program? Why not study the part of the genome that's functional? And who's going to fund research into something that is considered to be garbage? So nobody really characterized it much beyond just recognizing that there are different classes and that type of thing, or trying to explain mechanistically how that those junk DNA sequences may have emerged. But those were really minor efforts within the larger context of molecular biology. Now everybody is clamoring to study these non-coding sequences and doing it with the idea that they're functional.
So the principle is correct, but the application to saying that evolution led to all this fruitful research is you would take issue with that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, and for example, from a Christian perspective, the idea that a creationist viewpoint specifically, not just ID, but a creationist viewpoint will stultify science, I think is unwarranted as well. I mean, we look, for example, in Genesis 2, Adam is naming the animals. He was functioning as a zoologist. He had to study and understand the animals before he could assign characteristics to them. From a Christian perspective, we know that God is revealed through the record of nature. So studying nature is thinking God's thoughts after him. It's recognizing – it's an act of worship. It's recognizing and understanding God's glory. And two, we're taught as Christians to love our neighbor as ourself. And so that would motivate us into the biomedical arena. And what we understand biomedically speaking, we can then apply – to develop treatments for people who are suffering from disease or from injuries. And that is a way in which we love other people. In fact, how many hospitals and medical institutes are there that are from a Christian perspective and motivated by Christians to establish? Or the idea that we are commanded to take care of the earth. We're God's viceroy. We're God's stewards for the planet. And that promotes studying the record of nature just simply to understand what is entailed in that process.
And Fuzz, if it wasn't for Christianity and the Reformation in particular, there would have been no scientific method application and no scientific revolution.
Yeah, so there's plenty of motivation to pursue productive scientific research from a Christian perspective and from an ID perspective.
Well, as you certainly are aware, it's an important issue to keep in mind, this idea of fruitful research. In my own background is in the oil and gas industry. I worked with geologists for 30 years and came to appreciate the contribution of old Earth uniformitarian geology. And that's one of the strongest arguments in my mind against flood geology is that you have 100 years or, well, really going on 200 years of research in old Earth geology that's contributed to the oil and gas and mineral industries, and flood geology really has not contributed anything. So I just want to make sure I'm consistent as I apply a principle to in the area of geology, make sure I apply it consistently in the ID versus evolution debate.
Absolutely. Those are good thoughts, Jeff. I'm going to thank you for your call. We have a special in-studio guest right now. A frequent caller to the program was coming through our offices today on a little tour, our friend Randy from Colleyville, Tennessee. Welcome, Randy.
Thanks.
And so we thought we'd just throw you in the deep end here and let you ask your question on the air.
Okay.
So why don't you get a little closer to the mic there, and then you can ask the guys your question.
This is going to be tough because we got nothing on the monitor to indicate what he's going to ask us about.
Yeah, we're going blind here. All right.
That's all right. Well, thanks, first of all, for just letting me come in. It's a privilege, and it's just great to be here. And when you guys asked me to come up with a question, about a dozen things hopped in my head. But I narrowed it down to a couple, and one thing I hear at my church some from some people, when we talk about probabilities, you know, Hugh, you've got the list of design components of the universe, and you start multiplying the probabilities out, and you know, and we get to these huge numbers, like 1 in 10 to the 200 chance of an Earth-like planet being found or appearing in the universe. And a lot of people in my church aren't scientifically don't have backgrounds in that. And so when they hear that, they think, well, this one in whatever big number it is still leaves almost a doubt in their mind that something could still happen because there's still that one chance.
It sounds possible.
Sounds possible to them. How would you respond?
Well, one scientist put it this way, is that, you know, we have this new lottery that involves like 12 states where you can win like $500 million. But the odds of your winning, in his opinion, was the same whether you bought a lottery ticket or you didn't buy a lottery ticket. And so his whole point is that when the probabilities get really tiny, then it's fair to say that they're indistinguishable from zero. You know, one example I give is that there is a finite probability that in the next 5 minutes you could be killed by all the air molecules in this room below the freezing point of water ganging up in the vicinity of your head and freezing it into a cube of ice.
The reversal of the second law of thermodynamics?
Well, statistical mechanics tells us that, you know, all these molecules are in random motion, but there's a very tiny probability that you could happen to have all the coldest molecules in this room, you know, hit the left side of his head in the next few minutes and kill him. But when you
aren't you glad you're in studio?
Yeah. Randy can't wait to come back now.
But, you know, when you calculate what that probability is, it's down around 1 chance in 10 to the 80th. And
so 1 chance in 10 to the 80th is what? It's very unlikely.
It's indistinguishable from zero. I mean, I would be confident as astronomers saying that probability is so tiny that kind of incident has never happened any time anywhere in the universe. The universe is 14 billion years old. It contains 100 billion trillion stars. It's huge, but that probability is so tiny that we are completely justified as physicists saying it has never happened anywhere, anytime. Therefore, when we develop a probability for finding a life support planet without divine miraculous intervention that can support life, where that probability is less than one chance in 10 to the 282, that's 10 to the 200 times more remote than something that's indistinguishable from zero. In other words, it's impossible that that kind of planet could exist unless the miraculous hand of God is there to shape it in a fashion where life can exist. So giving people examples, and you know, one example I've given them is to say, to appreciate this one chance in 10 to the 282, let's blindfold an individual and give them the task of picking out one colored dime from a pile of dimes that fills the entire universe where there's no space between the dimes. Now, you can work that number out. That adds out to about 10 to the 82 dimes. And so, you know, what's the chance?
Of course, you figured that out.
What's the chance that you're going to be able to pull out a single marked dime from a pile that fills the entire observable universe, and to realize the probability of finding a life support planet is 10 to the 200 times more remote than the possibility that you could pick out one dime from a pile of dimes filling the whole universe, and it would be that marked
so
dime.
You'd need 200 universes full of dimes.
10 to the 200 universes.
Oh, 10 to the 200.
Yeah, you would need 10 to the 200 universes full
right,
of
right,
dimes.
Right, right, right.
Okay, let's go out and talk to James. We got to move on here.
I
only
that was your question, I presume. Did you, you didn't have a follow-up or anything?
Not a follow-up. I have another one if you want.
All right, well, we'll see how time goes here. Let's go talk to James in Michigan. Welcome, James.
Hello.
How can we help you?
Yes, I have a question. I was wondering if either of y'all had heard of a Kennewick man.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, well, Kennewick.
Kennewick, yes, sir.
Right.
My question is, apparently the skeleton was human, not humanoid, but human, and it was approximately 9,200 years old. I was under the impression that the flood was about 6,500 years ago. I could be wrong on that, but that's from the research. That's what I've understood. And if it's a global flood, or wasn't a global flood, it was universal, how could, because they found the skeleton in Washington State, how that could correspond to a global flood as opposed to universal?
Well, let me jump in and make the point that our biblical model places the flood more in the neighborhood of 30 to 40,000 years, not 5,000 years. And that's based on a calibration that we've done of the Genesis 5 genealogy. Genesis 11. If you look at Genesis 11, it mentions a line running from Noah down to Abraham. And all scholars agree that those 10 names are not the complete list.
Mm-hmm.
But what you can do is take the two individuals in the list for whom we have good external dates. One of those would be Abraham. Both the biblical date and historical records outside the Bible place him as living about 4,000 years ago. Likewise, we have halfway down the genealogy the mention of Peleg, and it tells us in Genesis 10:25 that the world was divided in the days of Peleg. I believe that's a reference to the breaking of the Bering Land Bridge, which for the first time prevented humanity from traveling from Siberia to Alaska. And I think that was critical in the context of Genesis 11 of guaranteeing that humanity would remain globally distributed. Now, that has been accurately dated through carbon-14 analysis to have taken place at 11,000 years ago. So if Peleg lived 11,000 years ago, and if Abraham lived 4,000 years ago, and if the lifespans recorded in Genesis 11 are proportional to the passage of time, that would put the flood of Noah in the neighborhood of 25 to 35 to 40,000 years ago, and would put the creation of Adam and Eve in a neighborhood of 50 plus or minus 20,000 years ago. And those dates are consistent with the best secular dates we have for the historical record of Genesis.
So Kennewick Man then would come after the flood, after the Tower of Babel, people have started spreading out over the face of the earth.
Right. Okay. It'll be shortly after the initial migration of humans into North and South America. And incidentally, there's here in Los Angeles, they've pulled a woman out of the La Brea tar pits. And she came in at 9,500 years old.
Yeah, I, Actually, I've been to the La Brea Tar Pits.
Probably seen that gal,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, my six-year-old's drugged me there three times already. Fuzz, did you want to say anything
else
about
No, I thought that was an
excellent
right. answer.
Okay. Because you were just saying during the break, just to throw this in there, that they're going to do some genetic testing on Kennewick Man to try to determine his maybe ethnic origin.
Yes. What's interesting about him is he has European features, not features consistent with him being a Native American. So that's got everybody very interested in his genetic makeup.
Okay, I hope that helps you out, James. I'm going to quickly run out to our friend Joe in Bismarck, the Olivine Man, right?
Okay.
Hello. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Sorry. I just got a couple of questions. Number one, I've been following up on a little bit on the magnetic, if you want to say, the magnetic record in the mafic rocks and how that points to an old Earth, you know, in relation, you know, relative to a young Earth. Then the other thing was, I guess my real question is, has anybody been following any more about the, if you want to say, the water controversy on Mars? I just saw a paper online. A couple of scientists looked at meteorites from Mars.
Right.
And they noticed that the argon in the rocks had a high, or I should say there was a high content of argon in the rocks relative to its age. And their belief is that, or I should say that the theory is that argon is released from a rock through, if the temperature is maintained high. And so when it's during its formation, so this one here says that it was or I should say over years, and so what they're saying is that for the last 3 to 4 billion years, the temperature of Mars had to be extremely cold in right. order for the argon to remain in the rock as much as it did.
Right, right. This paper is now published. I think it's in the latest Science, and it is something we're going to be writing up as a Today's New Reason to Believe, and hopefully we'll be able to talk about it on Creation Update as well. Because I think it is a good study in showing that with these Martian meteorites, they use the NAC lights and the ALH84001 to conclude that for the past 4.2 billion years, Mars has been dry and cold. And that's significant because there was a lot of speculation that Mars might have had a warm, wet episode
right.
between 3.7 and 4.2 billion years. These meteorites seem to contradict that
right.
conclusion. So we'll be writing that up, and hopefully we'll even be able to talk about it on Creation Update.
All righty.
So, but thank you for bringing it up early. That's great.
All right, thank
no,
you.
It is a remarkable study in support of our model. So.
Yeah, it was. I thought it was a very interesting paper.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks, Joe.
Okay.
All right. Randy, why don't you wake up there and do it? I got about 6 minutes, so
okay.
why don't you ask another question?
Okay. Just talking about arguments for design, a criticism often leveled, I think, is that we're seizing on events after the fact. Maybe you know, you guys have discussed this before. I think post-addiction is one of the terms that's used. These events which may occasionally happen anyway, however unlikely. For instance, one example I can think of is a piece of paper on a table that gets blown off and it drifts down to the floor and lands on its edge and sits there for a while. I've seen that happen. It's a very unlikely event. Obviously, though, design is not involved. And so are we seizing on events in a similar way when we see things that appear to obviously be design? Could they be just something like this that would happen anyway?
No, I think that's a possibility, which is why you don't want to have a list of design characteristics that has only 3 or 4 items on the list. So one of them might fall into that category. And, you know, I've been working on this for over 20 years, 30 years actually. And what I've noticed over the past 30 years is that there have been things I've identified as design that I later discovered wasn't as well designed as I thought it was. And so in my future publications, I've had to reduce my claim for design on that one parameter. On the other hand, there are other characteristics where the level of design was greater than what I thought it was. And so I have to make adjustments in that direction. But Which is why when we go out and speak on this, you know, Fuzz and I go out to these university campuses and roll out our testable creation model. The statement we make is that the more we learn about the universe, the record of nature and life, from our perspective, we would expect the number of characteristics showing fine-tuning design would increase, and that the degree of fine-tuning would increase. But we're not saying that for any particular characteristic, because we're human, we don't understand the phenomena totally, and therefore in any one particular characteristic we could be erring by being too conservative or not conservative enough. But if we look at the entire ensemble, our expectation is the more we learn, the more evidence we should see for supernatural design, both in the number of characteristics showing design and the degree of design. So we average over the whole list.
You know, I would build off of what Hugh says there with respect to how I like to argue for design in biochemical systems. Michael Behe has developed a very good argument for design with this idea of irreducible complexity. But there are scientists who are attempting to show how irreducible complexity could originate through natural means alone. And their argument is very similar to the example you cited about the paper falling off the table and winding up on its edge. I've seen similar type of attempts to reconstruct what would be considered irreducibly complex systems by those means. I don't know whether or not those arguments at the end of the day are going to pan out. But I do know that when I see systems that are designed, they appear to be irreducibly complex. So I think the argument has a lot of merit. And it's hard to envision how those systems could come into existence through an evolutionary process. But that's just one feature in the cell's chemistry that indicates design. There's information. And when you look at information, you can subdivide it in a number of ways, where each subdivision in and of itself argues for design. There's quality control systems. There are molecular motors. You see this fine-tuning and high-precision these high-precision interactions. There are chicken and egg systems, for example. When you compare what you see in the cell with regard to its chemistry versus what we can accomplish in the laboratory, there's no comparison at all. What we see in the cell is far superior. So to me, the argument for design is not that there's a single characteristic that defines life's chemistry that makes it appear designed, but there's a litany of characteristics independently that argue for design, but as an ensemble, they seem to make a very powerful weight of evidence for design. And plus, many of these characteristics interact in interesting ways. The information that argues for design specifies the molecular motors that appear to be designed, and they in turn are irreducibly complex. So it's not only a weight of evidence, but the evidence seems to integrate and interact.
Let me give you an historical example. Immanuel Kant, 200 years ago, took the 9 cosmological arguments for God's existence from Augustine and Aquinas and said, I can show how each one of these is inadequate. The fallacy was he was looking at one and ignoring the other 8. If you put all 9 together like the Bible does, then you have an irrefutable case for the God of the Bible. So this is advice that we Christians should not simply focus on one argument. We need to integrate across all that's been revealed to us in the record of nature.
Very good. Okay, and I do want to remind everyone that next week the studio will be dark and we will not have a broadcast on August the 16th, but Hugh and Fuzz will be back here on the 23rd. And they will be live, so if you want to call in with your questions then, you can do that. And we'll also be helping y'all get to know a little bit more our new staff scholar here, Dr. Jeff Zwierink, will be in studio, and I don't know, maybe he'll do some discoveries with you, Hugh.
Well, he's working on a bunch right now.
Yeah, whatever you can rope him
into. Including the one on Mars. Yeah. I gave him the Mars one as an assignment.
Oh, okay.
So that might be fun.
Yeah, and so Fuzz will be sitting in for me, being the glorified timekeeper and camel wrangler here on the show, and then I'll be back in a few weeks. Going to go take some vacation up in Oregon for a little while. I haven't had a vacation in a while, so we're going to do that. And we will be back in 2 weeks, so be sure to tune in then as Hugh and Fuzz talk about the scientific discoveries of the week and how they provide powerful new evidence for the God of the Bible. And always remember, the more we know about science, the more we have reasons to believe.
This has been a presentation of the Ministry of Reasons to Believe. If you would like to know more about other resources offered by Reasons to Believe or have questions about issues related to science and the Christian faith, please visit our website at reasons.org or call us toll-free at 800-482-7836.